Welcome to the Pursuit of Wellbeing podcast. My name's Maria Brosnan. I'm the founder of Pursuit and your host for the show. This podcast is dedicated to providing wellbeing information, inspiration, and support for teachers, leaders, and school staff around the world. Before we get started, you can find a video version of this episode on our YouTube channel, Pursuit of Wellbeing.
Today, my guest is Dr. Sue Roffey. Sue is a psychologist, academic, author, activist, and speaker. I love that word, activist. She's currently an honorary professor at universities in the UK and Australia and the director of Growing Great Schools Worldwide. Sue is a prolific author, having written chapters, blogs, and numerous books on issues related to school and student wellbeing, such as behaviour, relationships, and social and emotional learning. Sue, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Maria.
I want to just dive straight in. We're recording this in August 2020, and so teachers and leaders are preparing for the new academic year here in the UK and across the Northern Hemisphere, at least. Help us help them. What do they need to be bearing in mind now? What would help them with their own well-being and to support the well-being of their students and young people?
I mean, it's a huge question, isn't it, Maria, really? There's been so much change and challenge in the last 6 months or so, possibly a bit longer. And there's a lot of uncertainty about what's now going to happen in schools. I think one of the things it's probably worth saying is that there are things that are within teacher control and there are things that they have absolutely no control over. So they need to focus as much as they can on things that they can do and say that will actually support the students, the children who come to school, and also their own well-being. We can spend so much time and energy talking about things that we can't do very much about. Yeah. And I think that that's important in terms of the preservation of both emotional and physical energy.
Yeah, and I think talking about these things, but also internalising that and feeling worried and anxious is...
Absolutely. I mean, it was quite interesting for me at one point. I was doing a training course and there were a number of people saying, we struggle here with doing... It was in Australia and it was the equivalent of SATs, the NAPLAN courses that they do, the tests that they do. And one of the teachers said to me, actually, she says, we have to do the tests because everybody has to do them. She says, but it's not the focus of our conversation. He says, we don't talk about it in the staff room very much. We talk about the kids' well-being and a range of other things. She says, and that actually means that our focus is around different issues and it doesn't raise everybody's anxieties, because the teacher's anxieties get raised around things like that and around things about going back to school, and so do the students. Emotions are very contagious, and so the more anxious and worried the adults are, rather than being reassuring and clear and helping kids feel a bit calmer, the more children will be calm themselves.
For sure. And so can you give us some specific tips or tools or strategies that can help teachers or leaders if they are feeling anxious, and understandably so, there's so much uncertainty, as you say, what can they do to manage those difficult emotions?
I mean, I think it's really important to remember that it's the little things that make a difference in one direction or the other. A lot of the conversations the negative conversations are around the really big things. So in terms of managing anxiety, I think you think about, well, what's within my remit? What can I do? What can I actually leave at the door? One of the things I remember is about my first teaching job. There was a little boy there. I was teaching little children, 5-year-olds, and he was hugely in need. He was apparently quite unloved and his behaviour was quite difficult. And my heart went out to him, and there was part of me which thought, well, I'd like to take him home and look after him. I'd like to adopt him. And, you know, it took me 2 seconds to realise that that was completely unachievable. Mm. So what I decided to do was actually make his experiences in school as good as I possibly could while I was there with him. And then I'd go home and have a glass of wine and forget about it. And I think that that's one way of teachers preserving their own well-being, is that they do what they can within the parameters of what they have. Mm. And then they don't worry about it so much afterwards.
Yeah,
it's also about thinking optimistically, thinking about the way they talk to each other, because teachers and conversations can either focus on how terrible it is or what they can all do to support each other. Teacher well-being is around what you can do for yourself, but it's also about what we can do for each other, and relationships is at the top of that, of course.
Yeah, and I've heard you speak about social capital in schools. Can you tell us what you mean by that and what we can do to develop that?
Well, there's lots of different definitions of social capital, starting off sort of many years ago. And it was about basically old boys' network. It's about how, you know, your mates can help you get on in life and who you know. And there's still elements of that. Mm. And then David Putnam talked about community in America and how people were becoming increasingly disconnected from each other. Mm. And now the meaning of social capital is really around the quality of relationships in schools, and it's the levels of trust. It's whether or not you can rely on people. And one of the things that sometimes teachers forget is that they provide some of the most reliable, predictable places for young people anywhere in their lives, for some of them.
Yeah.
But social capital is around all of the relationships in a school. It's relationships that teachers have with the students. And we know from all of the work that's been done, John Hattie and his amazing meta-analysis, the relationship that teachers have with students is the most important factor in effective education. But it's also the most important factor in resilience and in well-being. And I think that we should stop talking about social distancing, and we should start talking about physical distancing, because we absolutely do not want social distancing in schools. We need people to talk with each other, to support each other with the words that they say, and that includes, you know, leadership and how leaders actually talk to their staff and how they engage their staff. It's about levels of agency and whether or not people feel they have a voice and they have a say in what's happening around. If you think that you're just being controlled from outside, then you lose your motivation. It's very easy to actually blame everybody for things that go wrong, rather than actually being given a voice.
I just want to pick up on something that you said in the middle of that about social distancing versus physical distancing, and that is such a powerful point, isn't it? Because that can be quite conditioning, especially for young people and very small children, that if we think that other people are a threat in some way, that goes very deep, doesn't it? And so the difference between social distancing and just physical distancing is a massive...
I think it was a major, major mistake, really, with the government generally, that they talked about social distancing. What they needed was that people didn't touch each other, and I think that in itself is a problem. We've seen so powerfully with all of the lockdown that we've had that it's the connections between people that matter, and a lot of people have actually revisited what's important in their lives in terms of how differently they're connecting with the people around. We had clapping for the NHS in our street for all of the Thursdays where they had clapping, and after the clapping, members of our neighbourhood got together and, you know, brought out a bottle and a glass or orange juice or whatever, and they stayed out talking, and we're still doing it. And that, you know, we're physically distancing, but we're actually socially more together than we have ever been. And the importance of belonging in school and connecting with each other in school is critically important. So, you know, I think it would be a great benefit if schools actually started talking about the difference between social and physical distancing and promoting as much social connection as they can, because it underpins well-being.
You make a wonderful point. And how, what are some really practical, down-to-earth tactics that people can do? How can we promote that social connection at school, especially at this time of physical distancing?
Well, I still think that people are still going to have to talk to each other. And I think that it's what they talk to each other about really makes a difference. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of work in social emotional learning, as you know. And one of the things that I do in the way that I do social emotional learning, which is SOCL Solutions, using the ASPIRE principles of agency, safety, positivity, inclusion, respect and equity. I could talk about that.
Say those again. That was so powerful. Can you say those again? The ASPIRE
principles are agency, which is giving people a voice so that they take more responsibility.
Yeah.
It's safety, and it's physical and emotional safety. So mistakes are not only accepted, but they're welcome as a pathway to learning, and that nobody's singled out. And I think that we have far too much competition in schools, because by and large, there's going to be winners and losers if you have lots and lots of competition. Some of our kids are always losers because they don't meet the sort of the academic credentials that others, you know, might find much easier. It's positivity, and a lot of my work is based in positive psychology. So positivity is around kindness to each other. It's around things like focusing on kindness. It's focusing on gratitude. It's focusing on things that we can be grateful for and thankful for. It's about. It's also about play, and we don't have play in our schools at a huge cost. Positive emotions, we know from Barbara Fredrickson's work that negative emotions shut down thinking. Anxiety shuts down thinking. So positive emotions, which are the opposite of that, open up creative pathways. They open up the ability to problem solve. So one of the things that we need to be thinking about is, how do you promote positive feelings in the classroom? One of those ways is to get kids to laugh together. It's really important that they do things that engage them in playful activities. They can do very simple things to get to know each other. One of the things that I would do was mix everybody up, so that children talk to people that they don't usually talk to in their social circles. Now, I know that's going to be more difficult when we go back to school because people are going to be in smaller groups. But it's also about giving people opportunities to tell their stories and for people to find out a bit more about each other. And one of the silly things you can do is to mix everybody up and say, find out something that you both hate to eat, for instance. Mm-hmm. So they have a bit of a, you know, they have a bit of a laugh together talking about things, but they also make connections. They're talking with each other. They're listening to each other. Listening is so important in education. We want people to listen and to listen well. And if they are, especially if they're going to sort of feed back some of that to other people so that they have this conversation and then they report back their findings, then that actually, it's a very little thing. And as I've said before, it's the little things that matter. Yeah. Those things actually promote connection, which brings me to the I for inclusion. And inclusion is about two things, really. It's about welcoming everybody, regardless of their background, their colour, their ability, their orientation, or what have you, welcoming everybody, but also giving everybody a role so that everybody feels that they can participate. It's all very well saying you're including people and then just the support being one way. We need support to be both ways. One of the things I saw when I was working as an educational psychologist is a boy who had Down syndrome who was in a mainstream class, and he was the one who took the football out to play every day. So everybody was congregating around him rather than, you know, leaving him to one side because he was the one with the ball. Seemed to me to be a very sensible thing to do. And there's a whole range of things that you can do to foster, you know, that sense of belonging. And it's so many of the little things. The words that teachers say to kids, you know, all of those sentences beginning with I. I did a bit of training for some Singapore teachers a couple of weeks ago. And one of the things they were interested in, because they didn't really know enough about it, and I sort of assume everybody does, is that we use sentences beginning with I. You know, I've noticed that, I wonder that, I like the way you, rather than you, which is a bit like finger pointing. And then the R is for respect, which is about good listening to each other, not making quick judgments, not assuming things, not using your authority to disempower, but to empower other people. And then the final one is equity. And one of the things that we have in our schools at the moment is around teacher control. And this actually also fits in with the agency. And we know, for instance, that there are some children who need more support, more help, more access than others. And this is going to be even more true after we go back to school. It's a bit like, you might have seen that cartoon where there's a man sitting behind a desk and saying to an elephant and a fish and a monkey and various other creatures, yes, we all have exactly the same test, go climb that tree. And it's like, well, that's very fine. The fish is always going to think of themselves as a loser because they're not going to be able to climb a tree. And although that's a, you know, that's a bit of a daft example, it's actually really important that we think, how do we enable people who struggle to have access to actually be flexible? And it's not about everybody being treated exactly the same, which is a bit of what we have in our education system at the moment, which is, for my liking, much too homogenous. We need to have something that is diverse so that we can enable every young person to develop their strengths. And of course, that's another thing in the positivity. It's that strengths-based language, yes. You know, looking at not what kids can't do, but what they can do and how they build on that, and looking at their character strengths. And there'll be a lot of your colleagues and mine who are looking at issues around character strengths and how we can help kids not necessarily feel that they're, you know, that what's important about them is whether or not they're good at maths or not. Not saying that that's not important, but actually what's also equally important is whether or not they are trustworthy, whether or not they are friendly and they know what it means to be a friendly person, whether or not they try hard. My dad always said to me, I don't care how you do, what you do, so long as you try your best. And for me, that seems to make sense, you know?
Perfect sense. I would like to jump to some questions from Twitter, if I could. So Andrew Cowley at Andrew_Cowley23 asks, Sue, how would you respond to a colleague dismissing wellbeing as fluffy or not worth the effort?
Okay, well, the colleague, it's very difficult, this one.
Big question.
Because the colleague has really not read any of the rafts of research and books that I've spent my life reading. And I was involved in the Australian federal scoping study on student wellbeing, and what came out of that quite clearly, which is why wellbeing is being taken on board so powerfully in some schools, and a lot of them around Australia, is that wellbeing, a focus on wellbeing as the central plank of your school, and we need to define what well-being, which is basically about maximising the ability of everybody to flourish in their own way. And in a way, it's about the whole child, not just parts of the child, just not sort of their academic ability, it's the whole child. But a focus on well-being does several things. It promotes more pro-social behaviour. It increases mental health and well-being, obviously, and resilience. It promotes more resilience and well-being in teachers. And this is really important, it also improves academic learning for all. Yeah. Now, one of the pillars of well-being is social and emotional learning. UNESCO have just put out a new book. I was involved in co-writing one of the chapters of that about the importance of social and emotional learning. But the American research says that when social and emotional learning is in place, their meta-analysis of thousands and thousands of students is that it produces about an 11% increase in academic outcomes. So if you really are serious about children doing well in school, all children doing well in school, then it makes sense to actually think about kids are not going to do well if they are traumatized, if they are miserable, if they think they're losers, if they don't get on well with other kids, if they think the teacher's got in for them, if they're punished when their behavior is not what is considered acceptable. I'm not saying that nothing should happen, but I've got a lot of views about what should happen. Punishment for kids who are already struggling with adversity doesn't seem to be a very sensible thing to do, in my view. I've lost track now. Where was I?
You were answering Andrew's question about missing well-being is fluffy, and by the sounds of it, there is so much research.
And what I'd start with that teacher is get them to talk about their own well-being. You can't have whole school well-being without teacher well-being.
Absolutely.
So you need to start off by saying, you know, what enables you to actually give of your best in a situation? And what do you need to be able to give of your best? And then you actually make that transition into, if that's what you need, then quite clearly other teachers and your students will need that as well. And that seems to me to be really sensible. There's a view, I know there's a view out there, that relationships and feelings are the icing on the cake in schools. And I will just turn around and say, no, they're not. They're the cake. They're from what everything else emanates, from how high quality the relationships are and whether or not you've got a school which has got a lot of positive emotions going on. Do people feel cared for? Do they feel that they matter to other people in the school? And if you've only got those kids who can get A pluses, feel that they matter, feel that they're important, what on earth is going on for all the rest of the kids?
So clearly, Andrew, it's not fluffy at all.
And it's quite challenging. Emotional literacy is quite challenging.
Absolutely.
And, you know, people sort of think that, you know, being nice to people doesn't matter. Well, of course it does. I nearly swore there.
I know. So a question from Dr. Chris Bagley at Hidden Depths on Twitter. I'm keen to hear Sue talk about alternative measures of education success. I think you covered a lot of that in your previous answer. Is there anything you would add to that for Chris about alternative measures of education success?
There's been a lot of debate around, and I've been listening to some of the things on Radio 4, and there's a number of people saying is that we've got to think about what is education for? What's it about? You know, what counts as success? And, you know, if you read biographies of sort of the famous people, a number of them say that they weren't great academic stars in schools. It was other things that actually enabled them to be a success. So we need to start thinking a bit differently about what success actually is. If we're working within the parameters of what we now have, at the moment what we have, by and large, I know other people might think a bit differently, by and large we have a test of short-term memory, which will be great for those people who are good at short-term memory, but not so hot for others. And there's a whole range of different ways that you can do things. When I was doing a master's course, one of the things that we were given is that we were given our exam questions the week before, so that we knew what we were going to write about when we were sitting writing in exam conditions, so that we were able to sort of think about how we might structure it, how we might research some of those things. Most of the things we're asked to do in real life is about being able to research something, being able to find something out. Yes, short-term memory or long-term memory is very important in some circumstances, but they become almost automatic when you actually have to do it over and over, like doctors might have to, or just learning to drive.
Mm. Oh, so, I want to bring you back.
Can I just say one more thing there? Is that also assessments need to be more than exams. They need to be, you know, the way people actually present things, the amount of work that people put in. And that being judged by teachers seems to me to be a reasonably sensible thing to do.
That makes a beautiful point back to the what you said at the start about what's in your control and what's out of your control. And I think many teachers listening to this or leaders listening to this might be thinking, we completely agree with you that the high stakes assessment that students currently have to endure, it's just so far out of our control. And of course, we believe in all of these different measures of success. What can we do about that? And bringing it back to wellbeing, how do we look at this in a way that's not going to just make us feel angry and upset that we're potentially harming our children or adding to their pressures that they're under? How can we support teachers in the current landscape of education as it stands?
I mean, I think you're absolutely right, Maria. It does come back to what's within your control and what isn't within your control. And knowing, I mean, one of the things that teachers are not positively evaluated on is the difference that they make to young people's lives, like the biographies are full of the difference that a teacher made at some point, and sometimes teachers don't even know that. So it's the words that come out of your mouth that really, really matter in terms of promoting a young person's self-esteem, the way they think about themselves, the way they think about what the possibilities are. Now, one of the things that has happened to me is that if I was ever to write an autobiography, and I'm too busy to do that, but it would probably be called Driven by Outrage. I'm furious about the way some of our kids are being left behind, about the focus on what's happening. I'm angry a lot of the time, but there's no point in being eaten up by that anger. So the things that I do is that I work as much as possible with other people who actually share my worldview and my view on education, so that I'm, and I think teachers can also do that. If there's a teacher who's really unhappy about this, you know, maybe she can be talking to others in her school about how they might together put forward a wellbeing proposal. If they want a wellbeing proposal that says that it's in the interests of the school, it's in the interests of the students, it's in the interests of the families, once they know what this is all about, if it's actually communicated well, then that's the way you might actually start to think about how much wellbeing can we have in our school. I mean, you and I both work in schools where we know very clearly that wellbeing is an issue. People are worried about mental health. They are worried about the fact that some of our kids might get, you know, 5A stars, but their mental health is in, you know, is in the toilet. It's absolutely critical that we look at the two dimensions of what happens in schools, one of which is the whole of the learning and the other is the well-being, and they're very much intertwined. They're very much connected with each other. And it's about talking to other people and promoting the positive wherever you possibly can. And it's the, again, it's the little things. Yes. You know, you sow seeds, you drop in a conversation, you show somebody an article that's been written that you think that they might value reading. You support other people doing things in the way that makes a child's life better. I mean, there's still so much around on, you know, the need to control and punish and behaviourist policies, you know, that are based in reward and punishment. There are lots of people now actually saying this isn't working and we need to think differently. And it's in teachers' interests to do that. Mm. And, you know, I think it's very tough. If you're in a toxic environment, then it's extremely tough for teachers. Fortunately, I think there's a hell of a lot of schools around where school leaders are working very hard for it not to be a toxic environment. And the opposite of a toxic environment is one where there's high social capital.
Well, that seems like a good place to wrap up. Sue, thank you so much for your wisdom and your insights. It's been wonderful hearing from you. Would you tell people about your latest books? I love the titles of them.
Okay. Well, funnily enough, much of my work, as some people know, has been around how we think about and respond to children who present with behaviour difficulties. So I wrote the Primary Behaviour Cookbook, and it's divided into sections which go from settling down to emotional distress. That's the chapter four. And I've also written the Secondary Behaviour Cookbook, which is for older children. In both of them, one of the first chapters is about the oven. And the oven is the culture of the school. Because if you're making a cake and you put it into a cold oven for 5 minutes, your mixture won't change and you won't get a cake. If you try any strategy for changing behaviour and you don't do it over time, consistently, in a warm, caring place, then nothing will change. The other book that was published in March is the third edition of this book, which is Circle Solutions for Student Wellbeing. And that is my framework for social and emotional learning that's based in the Aspire Principles. There's a whole chapter on what the Aspire Principles are.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Sue. Could you tell our listeners and viewers where they can get in touch with you on Twitter?
My Twitter handle is just at Sue Roffey. Mm-hmm. My website is www.growinggreatschoolsworldwide.com. And if you want to email me, it's just sue@sueroffey.com. It's about as easy as you can get, really. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm very happy to hear from people, talk to people about some of these ideas.
Well, it's been wonderful.
Thanks for the opportunity. And can I just say, I just want to thank all those teachers for doing what they're doing out there. You don't even know about the incredible job that you are doing every day, all day, for our kids. And you don't get thanked for it as often as you should. So I'm just doing that now.
Thanks so much for listening. Now check out our website, pursuitwellbeing.com, and take our free teacher anxiety quiz. I'll include the link in the description below. The quiz only takes a couple of minutes and you'll get a better understanding of where you are today, plus tips to immediately feel better. If you enjoyed the podcast, please hit the subscribe button in your podcast app. And if you feel inspired, please rate and review it and share it with your friends. I love getting your feedback and learning how we can improve our program.